Just how long can a company be successful if it's not successful raising money? Cities are putting a stop to those red light cameras. And a sit-down with the head of the Ag Department. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, the 25th of July, and it's great to have you with us. Amazon, in addition to changing how we shop, has perfected a kind of parlor trick of not making a profit, even though revenues are sky high. Yesterday, Amazon announced it lost $126 million in the last quarter, and the company expects to lose even more money this quarter. Well, investors weren't happy. They punished Amazon's stock today, dropped about 10%. Marketplace's Annie Baxter looks at just how long Amazon can continue losing money, hand over fist.
Amazon reported $20 billion in revenue in the second quarter, up sharply from the same period last year, but its costs rocketed, pushing it into the red.
That in and of itself is quite a feat, right, to be able to, you know, crank up the spending machine to that degree.
Colin Gillis is a technology analyst with BGC Financial. He says Amazon invests aggressively in many areas: e-commerce, its own smartphone, TV shows, and web services like document sharing. But Gillis and others wonder when Amazon, which has snubbed short-term profitability as a longer-term business strategy, is going to shift gears.
If they shouldn't be valued based on their profitability, what should they be valued based on?
Sucharita Malpru is a retail analyst at Forrester Research. She says other tech giants like Google and Facebook do turn in big profits even as they spend on innovation. Malpru doesn't think Amazon is doing anything too special with the money it's spending. For example, it heavily subsidizes shipping costs for stuff purchased at its website, a practice that's killing big box retailers.
I just think it's short-term stealing market share from your competitors in a way that isn't sustainable in the long term.
But RJ Hadavi, an e-commerce analyst with Morningstar, says Amazon is building a lot of brand loyalty along the way.
It's important to lock in those consumers and give them less of a reason to shop elsewhere.
Hadavi thinks that will pay off. But for now, Amazon is projecting more big operating losses, up to $800 million in the third quarter. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Health insurance companies are busy these days, busy writing checks. By the end of the next week, it's expected some 7 million consumers will start seeing $330 million worth of rebates. That averages out to around $80 a family. From the health desk at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein explains how these rebates work.
There's a simple reason why Obamacare architects created this insurance rebate provision, often called the 80-20 rule.
This is really a protection against insurers trying to gouge people.
Larry Levitt is with the Kaiser Family Foundation. And according to the federal government, the new rule saved consumers nearly $4 billion in premiums last year. Levitt says it's changed the nature of the insurance business.
It's in effect putting a cap on overhead and profits. And that's a pretty dramatic step that I think people don't fully appreciate.
The public might not, because most of us won't ever see a dime. If you get coverage at work, your company gets the refund or a credit towards next year's coverage. What about people who buy insurance themselves? Matthew Isles with Avalere Health says they might not see any money either.
You still might not get a rebate check because it's based on the group of individuals who are enrolled in a particular product. It's not each individual consumer.
And it's clear fewer and fewer people are getting those checks. When the 80-20 rule began in 2011, insurers paid out more than $1 billion in rebates. This year, it's a third that much. Isle says the industry has clearly figured out how to maximize profits under the new system.
It's almost pixie dust, really, if you think about the amount of premiums that insurers collect in hundreds of billions.
Paula Wade with Health Leaders Interstudy says with profits from premiums more limited, the industry is targeting consumers.
They do things like increase cost sharing. They'll increase deductibles that have to be paid before you get any benefit.
Wade says even though millions of us may be getting a little something-something in the mail from our insurer soon, she says consumers are paying more and more to be insured. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, as we said, markets were not so happy with those Amazon results. Details when we do the numbers.
Thank you.
It's Friday, which means it's time for the weekly wrap, 4 minutes of live radio during which we look back on the week that was. In our New York bureau, we've got Catherine Rampell, columnist for The Washington Post. Hi, Catherine.
Hey.
And Lynette Lopez with Business Insider. Hey, Lynette.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty well, thank you very much. So let me start with you, Lynette. This was a busy week on Wall Street. A lot of earnings came out. I remember looking on Sunday night to see what was coming up. It's like big tech companies every day of the week. We were hearing there in Annie's piece about Amazon. How do you interpret sort of what we learned from Amazon, especially during this week?
Well, Amazon was kind of an outlier this week. Most firms did pretty well. And if FactSet actually came out with a report this weekend, or rather last weekend, that about 70% of the 70-some companies that had reported at that point beat Wall Street earnings estimates. So Amazon is looking kind of weird right now.
Yeah, I mean, the big one that I remember, of course, is Facebook reported its earnings, and it seems like, you know, they have finally, it seems, figured out a way to monetize mobile.
They crushed it, as we would say, on Business Insider.
Very good. Catherine, bearing that in mind, you know, that these companies have been crushing it, I wanted to ask you about why we haven't seen the translation to the jobs numbers. In other words, we have these companies making a lot of money. It seems like they're squirreling a lot of that money away, that the people out of work aren't necessarily finding jobs as a result of these great earnings.
Yeah, they are sitting on a lot of cash, but I would quibble a little bit with your characterization of the job market.
Am I using the word squirreling? Oh, sorry.
Well, no. I'm 100% in support of squirreling as a word choice. But the jobs numbers have actually been pretty good. The numbers that we got for June were quite strong, were their strongest in many years. And beyond that, we actually had jobless claims released this week that were lower than they'd been, I think, since before the recession started. So there is some good news on the jobs front. Unemployment is falling. That doesn't mean that we're out of the woods yet. You know, we still have a lot of long-term unemployed people, a lot of people who've given up looking for work, who are probably, you know, very much in need of getting a paycheck. But it's not as if it's as bad as it was, you know, a couple of years ago even.
Lynette, let's talk inversions, which is a term we've been hearing a lot of lately. You know, these are companies who are finding clever ways to avoid paying U.S. taxes. It's something a lot of politicians here in Washington, where I am, have been talking about. And as the legislative session here comes to a close, as we get into these warm summer months, you know, how likely do you think it is that lawmakers are going to do anything about this other than just, you know, continue to talk about it?
I think the talking is definitely going to be the norm here. Different politicians have different plans on how to deal with this. Chuck Schumer's got one. The Republicans can't even agree on whether or not this is a problem, or rather on how to fix the problem. You know, everyone seems to be arguing different ways. What we do know is that tax inversions in 2014 are going to skyrocket. They could cost America about $40 billion, according to Goldman Sachs. So that's not it's not chump change.
Catherine, you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a growing issue. Tax inversions have been around for many years, but we've seen a huge ramp up in recent months, recent years, if not just in inversions and interest in inversions. And you know, for people listening out there, this basically means that companies can rename where they are officially domiciled for tax purposes and kind of skimp out on how much they have to pay Uncle Sam as a result. And so that means that if there's a company that you're competing with that has done this, that has decided that it's now located technically in Bermuda, that lowers their costs to some extent because they're not having to pay as much in taxes, and they can, you know, they can reinvest those profits and that sort of thing. So you could see sort of a knock-on effect where a lot of other companies are eyeing their competitors and saying, hey, they're taking advantage of this sort of sketchy tax scheme, but it seems to be legal. Maybe we should do the same thing. So it is very worrisome if you care about what happens to our fiscal coffers. And although it seems to be worrying politicians in theory, I agree with Lynette that it doesn't seem like anything much is on the horizon in terms of fixing it.
Technically in Bermuda, very good. Catherine Rampell with The Washington Post. Thank you, Catherine.
Thank you.
And thanks, Lynette. Lynette Lopez with Business Insider. You guys have a great weekend.
You too.
You too.
One of Wall Street's titans died today, Alan Greenberg, better known as Ace. He spent his career at Bear Stearns. Ace started out as a clerk, and eventually he became the CEO. During his tenure at Bear Stearns, Greenberg saw the investment bank grow from a small player to one of the industry's biggest. That is, of course, until 2008, when what happened to Bear Stearns signaled all the trouble ahead for the global economy. Dan Bobkoff has our story.
Ace Greenberg had no Ivy League degree. He was born in Kansas and grew up in Oklahoma. William Cohen is the author of House of Cards, which chronicles the fall of Bear Stearns.
He liked to gamble, he liked magic, he liked playing bridge, and of course the only sort of way to legally gamble at that time was to go to Wall Street.
Greenberg joined the firm in 1949, at the bottom. His trades made a lot of money, and by 1978 he was the boss, instilling in the company a culture both of risk-taking and frugality. Lee Munson, who worked at Bear in 2000, remembers getting his welcome packet with a note and some supplies from Greenberg.
You have 50 rubber bands and a box of paper clips, and to use them wisely throughout your career at Bear Stearns, because you're not going to get any more.
Greenberg stepped aside as CEO in 1993, leaving the company to his successor, James Cain. He had first met Cain playing bridge. Cohen says as Bear Stearns was starting to unravel in 2007, Cain was incommunicado at a bridge tournament. And Cohen says Greenberg developed a grudge against his former friend and successor for driving the firm into the ground.
That, of course, ignores Ace's role in it because Ace was part of the firm's DNA.
Greenberg was on the executive committee when the firm was sold at a bargain basement price to JPMorgan Chase. He told Kai Rizal on this program in 2010 they didn't have much influence by that point.
I did what I could. I tried as hard as I could. Kai, you have to understand that I was a very, very small shareholder of Bear Stearns during this period.
He told Marketplace that he regretted most all the Bear Stearns workers who lost their jobs in 2008. Greenberg died today from complications of cancer. He was 86. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's really alarming for the people that are in the broker-dealer seats.
Why stock market records don't necessarily translate to more money for traders. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shed 0.7%, 123 points, to close at 16,960. The NASDAQ gave back 0.5%, 22 points, to end the day at 44.49. And the S&P 500 was also down about 0.5%, 9 points, to finish at 1978. For the week, the Dow dipped 0.8%, the NASDAQ managed a gain of 0.4%, and the S&P ended the week more or less flat. Once again, earnings told the story. Starbucks sales were up more than expected in the second quarter, but apparently they weren't up enough. The coffee giant's stock poured down 0.2%. And on the flip side, Pandora, the streaming music service, gained 0.5%, even though listener hours slipped last month. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.46. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. The National Association of Realtors issues its pending home sales index for June. Denny's is hoping you ate a grand slam. It releases quarterly earnings. And Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis was born on July 28, 1929. She would have been 85. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdal. The federal government wants the private sector to invest more in rural America. That's a big goal of Tom Vilsack, the head of the Department of Agriculture. Vilsack announced the creation of a new fund this week designed to make it easier for investors to help finance schools, hospitals, and infrastructure projects. I sat down with Secretary Vilsack in his office at the Ag Department, and I asked him first why the fund would be appealing to investors.
Well, I think it's important for folks to understand that there's great profit opportunity and business opportunity in rural America. We're about 75% of the landmass of the United States. The vast majority of America is located in rural areas. It's where most of our food comes from, a lot of our water. So there's an importance to this place, and that's why I think it's worthy of attention and worthy of investment.
Talk to me about this moment in time. Why is this the moment for us to take a closer look at rural America, to engineer investments toward rural America?
Well, I think because they're great opportunities. I think we're learning more about how to use agricultural products to not just simply produce food and fiber and fuel, but now a whole wide array of chemicals and materials can be produced. So I think there's a lot of innovation that's on the cusp. I think the infrastructure needs of rural America are well documented. The American Society of Civil Engineers suggests that our infrastructure would rank a D+. Well, that's not good enough for us to be competitive in a global economy. We need that infrastructure to be improved. So the time seems to be right. The economy is beginning to rebound, but not all of the benefits of that rebounding economy have been spread equally around the United States. And so it's time for rural America to also benefit from an improved economy. But with this conference, these commitments, we think we'll see more job growth.
The president, the man you work for, has been making a lot of speeches about infrastructure. He's appeared in front of many bridges by now. The effort seems to be to get more Americans to care about infrastructure. Why do you think that that's so hard? You mentioned the D-plus rating on infrastructure. Why don't Americans care about it enough to bring forth this initiative themselves?
You know, it's a mystery to me, because there's no question every American has experienced some problem with infrastructure, a bridge that needs repaired, a street that needs repair, a highway that's not what it needs to be, a water project that's not being funded. We need to continue to make the case, the connection between your life and a better life and that infrastructure investment. There's also a need for jobs and skilled training jobs. The ability not to necessarily need a four-year college education. There are a lot of people looking for work that maybe have a community college education, maybe a high school education. These construction jobs, these trade jobs, are great opportunities for them to rebuild the middle class, to have an opportunity. So if we're going to be competitive, we need to step it up.
The president has made such a point of saying he's using the pen and the phone to get stuff done when he can't get help from Congress. You're somebody who had to work with or alongside Congress a lot on that farm bill, which took an awful long time. You know, what do you make of the relationship now between the administration, between you and Congress? How tenuous is it? How difficult is it for you guys to work together?
Well, there are good people working in Congress, and there are obviously some deep-seated beliefs and feelings. I think sometimes the great thing about the Farm Bill was that people, I think, understood at the end of the day there was benefit for everyone. And I think also there was a crisis looming. If we didn't get a Farm Bill done, there was going to be permanent law come into place. It was going to raise food prices for people significantly. And I think that crisis situation motivated Congress to take the right steps. It's unfortunate that a crisis is required in order for there to be action. So I think absent that, we have to look for additional ways to make sure that there's something going on. And that conference, the Rural Council's conference, is a way of stirring the pot.
Secretary Vilsack, thanks very much for taking the time today. It's good to have you back on the show.
It's great to be with you today.
Markets have been setting records pretty much every other week for months now. We've talked a lot on this program about the disconnect between the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the broader economy, but there's another disconnect. You'd think sky-high markets would translate to high times on Wall Street, but that's not the case. Things are tight on Wall Street these days, and they're getting tighter. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith takes a look at how the soaring Dow has left Wall Street behind.
The markets are setting records. Investors are making money hand over fist. And Wall Street, well, it's looking a little lean.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tough even for the people that are really good at it, to be honest.
Jesse Maris is the president of Street ID, a financial careers service. He says jobs on Wall Street have been drying up.
It's definitely an eat what you kill business. So there are people losing their positions in that space.
Why? Is there less of a killing to be made for Wall Street workers? I put that question to Wall Street economist Max Wolf.
Trading volumes are way lower.
Trading volumes, a.k.a. how many trades are done per day. That's where Wall Street makes its money. Take it from Mark Hanna, the outrageous chest-thumping stockbroker in The Wolf of Wall Street, played by Matthew McConaughey.
Name of the game, move the money from your client's pocket into your pocket.
Right, but if you can make a client's money at the same time, it's advantageous to everyone, correct?
No.
The Wall Street satire is set in the 90s. At that time, the markets were at about half of where they are today. But trading volumes were high, and being a trader was a very lucrative job. And as Hannah explains, investor wealth had nothing to do with it.
He thinks he's getting rich, which he is, on paper. But you and me, the brokers, we're taking home cold hard cash via commission.
Fewer trades mean fewer commissions, a lot fewer. Trading volume has been really low since the financial crisis. Last year, the number of trades was a third lower than it was in 2009. Max Wolf says a big reason for the low trading volume is the low level of investor enthusiasm.
This is one of the world's most hated rallies. It's been pretty clear that the markets got well ahead of the macroeconomic health of the U.S. And so everyone sort of kept waiting for this correction that didn't come. And slowly, begrudgingly, people jumped on board because they couldn't afford to just watch other people make money forever. But they didn't believe in it. And they definitely don't want to catch the elevator ride down that everyone's afraid may come.
So investors are putting their money in the markets and leaving it there. They're not buying a hot new stock or selling it off based on a hot tip. They're buying and holding. Lawrence White is a professor of economics at the NYU Stern School of Business.
For there to be trades, there have to be differences of opinion. Somebody's got to think it's a good time to buy, and somebody else has to be thinking it's a good time to sell. When trading volumes are lower, it just means there's less diversity of opinion, more consensus.
All of that consensus has had a very chilling impact on Wall Street, says Street ID's Jesse Maris.
It's really alarming for the people that are in the broker-dealer seats that really rely on the trading volumes. Despite the record highs, it's still really hard for them to make the commissions that they were making and make the livings that they were making because, you know, the volume's low and the volatilities are so low.
But even if the volatility and volume come back, the chest-thumping Mark Hanna of late 90s Wall Street probably won't rise again. Electronic trading has replaced brokers and traders to a large extent, which means the future Wall Street broker will probably sound a whole lot less like Mark Hanna and a whole lot more like,
"Good afternoon, Mr. Amer. Everything is going extremely well."
How? In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
We were talking about refunds at the top of the show. Well, some drivers in Chicago may get some money back from the city to the tune of $100. The Chicago Tribune discovered there were a few periods when there were inexplicable spikes in tickets generated by red light cameras. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel says at least 9,000 drivers who received citations during that time may be eligible for refunds. For years, red light camera hatred grew almost as fast as the number of cities using them. That is, until about 2012, when the number of programs started to drop. Marketplace's Dan Weissman reports.
Jeff Brandis is a state senator from Florida who proposed a bill that would have put some limits on red light cameras there. For instance, media reports showed that after some local governments put in red light cameras, they also shortened the time for yellow lights.
Well, reducing yellow light timings has never been shown to be safer, but it has been shown to generate a lot more red light camera revenue.
A state report he requested did show revenue going up year by year. His poster child was a mom who missed a yellow light on a rainy day. He says no actual cop would have written her a ticket.
I mean, there is a human element to law enforcement, and we're taking that out.
Of course, drivers hate the gotcha every time factor, says Joseph Schofer. He's a civil engineering professor at Northwestern. And there's an upside if you want people to run fewer red lights. However, he recognizes that the money creates a conflict of interest.
If you're doing this to make money, set up a toll booth there, because that's much more transparent. Then we know what you're doing.
There's also a question about how well the cameras work. Some studies have shown that when red light cameras go in, rear-end crashes go up. However, Ann McCart is senior vice president for research at the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. She cites a study by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
While rear-end crashes went up, the more serious right ankle crashes went down by a greater extent. So there was an overall net safety benefit.
The Florida study that Jeff Brandis requested showed the same thing, and fewer T-bone crashes means fewer deaths. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, there's a new study by economists from the University of Chicago and a university in the Netherlands on generic products. Who's likely to spend a little extra for name brands and who isn't? The conclusion is professionals don't seem to care if what they're using is generic. More informed consumers, the study says, are less likely to pay extra to buy national brands. Take aspirin, for instance. 90% of the time, pharmacists buy generic aspirin. The same is true with salt and sugar. Chefs, it turns out, like to go generic. According to the researchers, chefs devote 12 percentage points less of their purchases to national brands than demographically similar non-chefs. So take that with you to the store next time you go. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow shed 0.7%, 123 points. The NASDAQ gave back 0.5%, 22 points. And the S&P 500 was also down about 0.5%, 9 points. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yor. It's produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm David Gura. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll see you on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.